Chapter 1. This from someone who freaked out at the word vagina, he said. I sat behind the checkout counter that overlooks the baby pink and chocolate brown throw pillows decorating the seating area in my store, the store the media had dubbed Westchester Sex Shop, and I couldn't help but laugh at the irony. I had called to fill him in on all my latest excitement. Front page headlines, radio interviews, small town scandal, and although the voice was intimately familiar, the conversation was awkward, strained, emotionless. I had to wonder, how did we get to this place? Rewind 10 years and I was an ugly 12-year-old with a bad perm and crooked bangs I'd cut myself, and Pat was a scrawny preteen with freckles and braces. At school, I was known as the dirty hippie, while he was known as the dorky redhead. We had been classmates since kindergarten, but that summer before 8th grade, I don't know if it was sheer boredom, convenience, or our mutual rank at the bottom of the middle school totem pole, we became friends. One afternoon, we were riding bikes down the alley behind my house, despite the crumbling cement and potholes that could swallow a bike tire, and he somehow discovered my prudishness. I was so straight-laced that I would actually cover my ears and squeal in disgust upon hearing sex-related terms, particularly the horrid V-word. The previous school year, I passed out in science class and nearly passed out again in health when the V-word was uttered, and once Pat learned of this, he proceeded to torture me, as 12-year-old boys will do, shouting vagina at the top of his lungs again and again until I flipped out and threatened to tell his mother. Pat's memory of this story and how such a girl grows up to own Westchester Sex Shop was the comic relief this cold phone call needed. Really, how did we get to this place? When I walked into the storefront that would become Feminique Boutique for the first time, the walls were neon green and the floors were covered in warped and peeling macaroni and cheese colored linoleum. The electricity had been turned off for months, but through the darkness I could see an empty liquor bottle still adorning an otherwise empty bar. Most first-time small business owners with visions of setting up shop as an upscale women's boutique and no renovation budget would have passed this fixer-upper by. I looked at the landlord as he scanned the dusty room with a flashlight, smiled, and said cheerily, "I'm definitely interested." What else could I do? I was short on options, because my women's boutique was not going to be your traditional purses and knickknacks kind of store. I was opening a feminist sex shop. My gram, grandpa, parents, teenage sister, and best friend George spent a cold Saturday in March helping me slap some paint over the hideous green of my new store. I even recruited the help of strangers to get the job done, like a man named Tyler Mano, who I had recently met and who stopped by some nights to lend a hand. After poring over the minute differences between Pastel Petunia and Priscilla Pink on the sample tabs in the paint store, I found that when the first wet roll of reality went up, my decision actually looked absolutely perfect. I was overdue for a win, and after a year of setbacks in launching a career, choosing the right shade of pink counted as a big win in my eyes. I had graduated from college in Canada nearly a year before with a unique bachelor's degree in sexuality, marriage, and family. I moved back to the States, and it took me 2 months to land my first job interview. I was psyched. The job was with a university organizing its sexuality information website for teens. I thought it sounded perfect for someone with my degree and passion for sex education. I bought a suit, did a dry run to ensure I would arrive on time, and spent the night before the interview awake with those "I'm so nervous I'm going to puke" butterflies. Luckily, I didn't puke, and as I took a seat around the oversized conference table, I gracefully moved from nervous into my natural groove of confidence. This was my passion, after all, and if there's one thing I know, it's sex. "Our culture has linked nudity with sexuality," I explained in a dignified tone to the bored woman who sat across from me, picking the dirt from underneath her fingernails. "And since our culture is rooted in erotophobia, now we see nudity being vilified. We see mothers getting arrested on child pornography charges for developing photos of their infants naked at bath time. It's absurd. I actually conducted my own research on this topic for one of my more popular articles I wrote for my..." She yawned, and my mind searched for reason not to get up and walk out right then and there. "My sex column," I managed to finish the sentence, despite my confidence being knocked down a peg with each flake of dirt that fell to the table in front of her. I quickly was growing to despise her. I don't know if she realized I was done talking or even that I'd ever started, but apparently caked fingernail crud was far more interesting than what I had to offer. I didn't get the job. This went on for 500 more resumes that I sent across the nation and a handful of similarly pitiful interviews. More than once, I had the, sorry, you don't have a master's degree, and sorry, you don't speak Spanish, doors slammed in my face. So I bought a Spanish learning CD and enrolled in a human sexuality's master's course program, meanwhile selling off the contents of my messy bedroom on eBay to fill my gas tank. I even got uninvited to an interview with the Sexuality Education Department of Planned Parenthood when they called to meet with me and then subsequently called to tell me not to bother coming in. Does this actually happen? This was my first go-around with interviewing in the real world, but I had to imagine this wasn't a good sign. As if this process wasn't already bad enough, now it was moving backwards. I wanted more than anything to be a sexuality educator. Ideally, I dreamed of someday traveling the country on speaking tours, giving seminars and motivational speeches on sexual empowerment at colleges, conferences, and other venues. I wanted to pack auditoriums with a fun and quirky sex education comedy show or a stage show. It was my 10-year career plan, but in the meantime, I would take it any opportunity, if only one would present itself. I got excited again when I received a call back early one morning from a pregnancy center. From what I read on their website, they were an organization that offered pregnancy testing and options counseling to women facing an unplanned pregnancy in order to educate them on all of their options. Once the woman had made a decision, she was referred to either an abortion doctor, adoption agency, or obstetrician. The woman asked me a few questions about my degree and experience, and then she asked me in the same professional tone, not skipping a beat, "Jill, how do you balance your faith with your role as a sexuality educator and counselor?" Come again? I couldn't believe she asked me that. I was confused and shocked. I was pretty sure it wasn't legal to ask questions about religion during an interview, but what was I going to do? Should I call her out or answer the question? Would answering it honestly cost me a job that I desperately needed? I don't balance my faith. I was going to say I don't have faith, but that wasn't entirely true. Plus, I thought saying that might screw me over for this job because obviously having faith was important to this woman. Otherwise, she wouldn't be asking me. And then I thought, why should I have to defend myself? Not only was her question illegal, but completely inappropriate. And if I was going to not get this job because of my religious beliefs, then I was going to go down with it up yours. Actually, I didn't think about any of this until I hung up the phone and realized how pissed off I was. But before I did that, I said, I don't believe one's religious beliefs, whatever they may be, should influence the way they educate or counsel others about sexuality. I think that's misleading and biased and unethical. Needless to say, I was not offered the job. I later found out that this so-called pregnancy center was actually a covert Christian organization with a mission to steer women away from abortion while hailing themselves as a health center offering legitimate counseling and a variety of options. I had been duped. And I wondered how many women were also duped by this agency and manipulated into carrying a pregnancy because they trusted these people. The only thing more unethical than using your power and authority and personal bias to influence the lives of others is doing so without revealing your agenda. After several more months of no callbacks from the resumes I sent to every clinic, health, community, or education center from Miami to San Francisco, my massive student loan debt came a-calling, and I was desperate for any type of paying gig, sexuality-related or not. I was unfortunate enough to graduate college in 2007, at the cusp of the worst economic recession since the Great Depression. That, coupled with President Bush's $100 million abstinence-only agenda, was not going to make starting a career in sexuality education easy. Just take what you can find for now, I told myself, and when the economy turns around, there will be more possibilities. Like the bitterness of a shot without a chaser, I grimaced, swallowed the pride of my Dean's List college education, and applied to be a part-time receptionist, even a Hooters waitress. But despite my excellent telephone voice and 35, 25, 35-inch frame, I was not hired for either position. I started to feel depressed, downtrodden, and was ready to give up hope. When I was passed over for yet another interview, this time for a job that paid barely above the poverty line and required me to stand on the street corners in the slums of North Philly handing out clean needles to IV drug users, I reached the end of my rope. "You are an excellent candidate," the interviewer said when she called me with the news. "But we decided to go with a bilingual applicant with a master's degree." To hell with this nonsense, I thought bitterly after hanging up, realizing with an angry ball of acid turning somersaults in my stomach that all of my roads were officially blockaded, snowed in, no outlet. I was fresh out of places to turn. So just like that, I decided if no one would pay me to be a sexuality educator, damn it, I would do it myself. I sold the Spanish learning CD at a garage sale for $4 and began writing my business plan. It was that impulse of a decision, just like that. All of these setbacks had brought me to a quaint little corner store in the winter of 2008. It had big windows and hardwood floors. The building was available for rent in the heart of Westchester, Pennsylvania, a bustling college town outside of Philadelphia with trendy shops and restaurants. As soon as I saw it, I began daydreaming about the finished product. I could already see in my mind's eye where I would put the lingerie racks, where I would house the shelves with massage lotion, how I would create a comfortable seating area for the sexual empowerment workshops I would teach. I envisioned the sensual artwork, which I already had picked out, on the walls, and the merchandise tables draped in pink satin. The commercial realtor I contacted about renting the building seemed delighted to have an interested renter, especially at a time when so many small businesses were having a difficulty weathering the recession. Things were finally looking up. My hard work was finally going to pay off. Instead, I soon found out that due to, quote, the nature of my business, the owners of the property would not rent to me. Of course they wouldn't. I'm calling to give the daily report, I announced as I'd done a million times before. What are you up to? Other 21-year-olds were partying, drinking, and watching television, but with my 15-hour-a-day job of starting a business, the only form of entertainment I could squeeze into my busy schedule was a daily rehashing session with my best friend, George, where I poured over every detail and idiosyncrasy of mundane everyday life, a la an episode of Seinfeld. I'm folding my laundry, he said. For most people, the conversation would veer into something like, well, that's nice, so what are we doing on Friday night? Ours went as follows. Me. Folding? You're a folder? George. Yes, I'm a folder. What are you, a hanger? Me. I've been known to hang for the most part, and even though the rest of my place is a disaster, my closet must be organized with all the hangers the same color and facing the same direction. George. Well, that's because you're insane. Me. No. George. Okay, well, what is hung and what is folded? That is the question. Me. Everything is hung, other than underwear. George. What about t-shirts? You hang t-shirts? Conversations like this were a foundational part of our friendship. Not many 11-year-olds fiercely debate politics, but on Election Day 1996, George and I spent the walk to the 6th grade bus stop intensely discussing Clinton and Dole. He grew up a mere 13 row homes away from mine, and since 2nd grade I remember playing house with him on our small rectangular lawns. Other girls on the street and I used lawn furniture for pretend living room, while George tried to bulldoze them down to build an imaginary courthouse in an effort to entice us to play lawyer instead. He was chubby and capable of speaking in anything but a boisterous, bellowing Italian-American tone of voice and talking with his hands. His incredible intelligence was offset by his cockiness, and growing up, all he could talk about was what he was being taught in school, as if it should be the most obvious thing to everyone else who had yet to learn it. His strict grandparents kept him on a tight leash, so he became one of the girls, playing our games or playing by himself. Anywho, I said melodically before any more of my life was spent discussing my laundering habits, I do have news to report today. Since, as you know, I couldn't get that corner store with the big windows and hardwood floors, I decided to rent another one, just 2 blocks away. He was happy that I found a place, albeit a rundown tavern with neon green walls, to house Feminique Boutique. Finally, something was going my way, although I think we both knew that the setbacks were only beginning.